I'm Rick Steves, and this is Travel with Rick Steves. Today, we're going to Wales, and I've got in town a friend of mine, Martin Delandowitz. Years ago, I was taking groups to northern Wales, and we'd always visit my favorite castle, Caernarfon Castle. And every time I come with a group to an important site, the site that I really want my group to enjoy, I just hope and pray I connect with a good guide. And for many tours in a row, I lucked out to have Martin as my guide. Martin and I became friends, and after a while, I actually started thinking of Martin as a guy who could be doing our tours all over Britain. I asked him if he'd like to do that. He said, sure. And he's, for 6 years, been doing tours for us at Europe Through the Back Door. Martin was born and raised in Wales. He's trained as an archaeologist. When Margaret Thatcher came on board, she tightened things up, and it wasn't good news for people looking for work as archaeologists, apparently, and Martin ended up becoming a tour guide in the castles of Wales. And Martin also teaches at the University of Wales. You'll see him occasionally in appearances dealing with Welsh history and heritage on the Travel Channel and on the History Channel. And today, we're thankful to have Martin Delandowitz right here in our studios. Martin, nice to have you here.
It's nice to be here, Rick.
We're thinking about Wales. A lot of people go to England, and England is a huge destination for Americans, and they don't know too much about Wales. To me, Wales is castles and slate mines and people who sing a lot. How would you characterize Wales in a nutshell for an American traveler? What would bring us to Wales?
You know, America's a very diverse and rich country. It has so many different climates, so many different environments. Britain's much smaller. And it has as wide diversification. Wales is so different to England. It's geographically different. It's environmentally different. It's climatically different. And, of course, it is ethnically different, because that's a Celtic country where Welsh is spoken in some parts by well over 90% of the population. So it's different in all ways. And the very short journey over the border from England is well worthwhile.
And you are encountering a lot of sites that were created because of the, let's say, antipathy between the Welsh and the English. Is that right?
Yes, it is. If you look at Great Britain as a partnership or a family, the senior partner always was England. And Great Britain as a political entity, England, Wales, and Scotland, was held together by this senior partner by force.
In other words, you're saying it was a coalition of the unwilling.
That is correct.
And consequently, I think there's more castles in northern Wales per square mile than anywhere I've seen in Europe.
Well, throughout Wales, in fact. We concentrate on the castles in North
Wales.
And
these castles are not generally Welsh castles, are they?
Some are. Welsh rulers trying to prove that they were as great as any built their own castles. But the greatest, of course, was built with the abundant wealth of England.
So England would establish these little toeholds with these castles.
Yes, very much as they did in France. If you go to places like Carcassonne, you're looking at the Bastide there in Gascony. You're looking at England putting out, well, as they did in America, colonial bases, defences against the native.
Now, when I look at an English castle in Wales, it comes with a little garrison town, which grows up to be the town today. Think of Conwy, for instance, in the north of Wales. Tell me a little bit about these garrison towns.
Well, they are. You have to picture this. And the good comparison is the John Wayne film. Look at somebody like Edward I as John Wayne. He, like John Wayne, was 6'4" tall, and he moves west, and the natives are hostile. So he builds forts in the frontier.
Hold on. Okay, so Edward I, he was the king of England with this rough and tumble frontier spirit, wants to colonize, bring those Welsh, like the American Indians, into civilization, right? Like John Wayne would do. So he builds his Boonesboroughs, or his whatever we want to call them, these little garrison towns fortified by a castle.
Yeah, and here come the settlers, and they are settlers, and they're in a frontier, and the natives will kill them.
Settlers from England?
From England.
Planted over there. To establish English presence in Wales.
Yeah, well, the castles actually need feeding. So the garrison towns become populated by people who are useful to a garrison. So there is your carpenter, there is your silversmith, so that the castle can exist. They become funnels through which the Welsh wealth, such as it is, can be funneled through to the English system.
So these wild and wicked and frightening Welsh natives could control all the countryside except for these little dots of English control, the castle and its established town within a wall right next to the castle.
Yeah.
How did they support it with supplies and so on?
There are two things to say here. Castles are often misunderstood. Basically, within a castle, you have a professional garrison, and they've got nothing better to do than sit behind the high walls and wait. They've got nothing else to do. Now, the average population, they're ordinary people like you and me. If we misbehave, they're going to come out of that castle and beat the heck out of us, and that's how castles control medieval society. You can't go round them. They're there in the countryside controlling the wealth of that countryside. Now, how do they supply them? Edward I is the King of England. His greatest economic interest is not in Wales, so he builds all his castles on the edge of the sea so they can be supplied, and if necessary, the garrison can be increased by sea. The Welsh are wonderful people, but they haven't yet learnt to walk on water.
So now, what century was Edward I?
He's end of the 13th, end of the 1200s, best known, of course, Patrick McGowan in Braveheart. Longshanks is who's known in that film.
Okay, so about the year 1300, England under Edward I is establishing these incredible castles. And I got to tell you, they're the most breathtaking castles you'll find arguably anywhere in Europe. And there's many of them. And they're on the sea, so they can be supported by sea from England, and which ruled the waves at that time, I suppose.
Yep.
And
yep.
This must have been state-of-the-art castle technology.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you actually look at something like Carnarvon Castle, it cost what was 90% of Edward's annual income. Edward I was bankrupt 14 years.
Edward I spent 90% of his country's income building castles in Wales?
On one castle.
On one castle?
On one castle. In all, 7.5 years' income was spent. He was bankrupt 14 years, thus establishing the old British tradition of overspending on defence. Now, that's something you haven't heard of here in the States, Rick, but yes, we were doing it 700 years ago.
Whoa, okay. So there's lots to learn when you go to Wales about castles and running your empire, I guess.
Yes, yes.
Now, something else about Wales is the slate mines, and we're getting up into the modern age. But when you go to Wales, my understanding is most of the slate roofs in Europe came from northern Wales, and this was a huge industry, but now it's quite depressed.
Yeah, in the south it was coal, iron and steel. How green was my valley, wrote Richard Llewellyn. But in the north it was slate. And not just, of course, in Europe, but slates from Carnarvon, where I come from, went to North America. Yes, North America, what is now the United States, to South America, to Africa, parts of India. Do you realize that in the 19th century, trains in India ran on rails made in South Wales?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal thought. And Wales was very much at the hub of the Industrial Revolution that really churned into life in the 19th century. It was the coal, iron and steel that Wales was producing. But of course, in North Wales, the slate.
Was Wales benefiting from the Industrial Revolution, or were they just the disadvantaged supplier of the Industrial Revolution?
Well, they benefited greatly. There was full employment. And, you know, there are stories of people starting in coal mines. One in particular I can remember, where the person started as the lad that made the tea for the workers and ended up owning the mine. And somewhere along that progression, he stopped being exploited and started exploiting. And it's all a matter of comparative, isn't it?
Now, today, there's not much slate mining going on, really, I don't think, because you go into these towns where everything seems to be made out of slate, and they're quite grim and glum and quiet. And the slate mines are just probably make more money taking tourists through them than actually mining slate. Is that true?
That's the case. There are a couple of slate mines still working. And where I come from, because the majority of the houses are over 150 years old, they have slate roofs, and it is compulsory under planning regulations that you must have a Welsh slate roof on your house.
So if you have an old house in Britain, the government requires that, huh?
No, where I come from, in North Wales. So that, for example, when Safeways move in and build their supermarket in Wales, they must have a Welsh slate roof on it.
So that's good for the local slate mining industry.
It's good for the environment.
But if you're a tourist coming in, Martin, what's some advice to understand and appreciate the slate industry? Where would you go?
I'd go to two places. Llechwedd in Blaenau-Ffestiniog, which may sound incomprehensible, but it really is a place. And the other place I'd go to is the Slate Museum of the North in Llanberis, which is not too far from Carnarvon. You've mentioned the castle.
Oh, yeah. I've not been to that. That would be an interesting way to follow up your visit to the mines, to actually go to the museum.
Yeah. The two things that you must do and understand in Wales are the medieval period with its castles, and to understand modern Wales, you have to understand its industrial past of 150 or so years ago.
We'll have those specifics at our ricksteves.com website for folks who want to check out the specifics, because give me that name again, Blaenau.
Blaenau-Ffestiniog.
Blaenau-Ffestiniog. Very good. Now, does the choir heritage, the music heritage, relate to the slate mines? I've got this image of guys down there singing lusty hymns during lunch breaks or something like this and never see the light of day almost, but they're down there splitting slate and singing their hymns.
That's right. I mean, there's a great travel writer in Wales. Yes, one even greater than you. Well, a bit older than you, Gerald of Wales, writing over 800 years ago, said the Welsh sing, but he also said the Welsh have no towns. Now, to have a choir, you've got to have people coming together. So in the 19th century, as people came together, be it in factory, mine or town, so they began to sing together. So the tradition of singing have been there for centuries. But coming together as choirs, recent, and don't forget, it was the men that worked, and so it is the male voice choir that is the famous choir in Wales. Although women sing excellently too, I have to say.
But I didn't realise that. That explains why you think of Welsh choirs as men's choirs.
Yeah, they were industry-based.
Now, as a tourist, you can actually go to these choirs. Actually, they're all every town, every community has their men's choir, and they enjoy practicing at the church on a certain day. And then my experience is they always go over to a pub afterwards, yes, and have a few beers and keep singing.
That's right. And that's when you I'm sorry to say, and that's when you tend to hear the best singing. The ties come off, the collars are loosened, and they let rip. And they're not standing on the stage with their hands held in front with their chests puffed out. They are letting loose. And the singing, it moves me to tears. I've lived there all my life. The hairs go up on the back of the neck. The power, the deep power of singing. And of course, it was in the nonconformist, principally Methodist tradition that these choirs grew. And so the Welsh choirs sing hymns, and the tunes and the words are so moving.
Isn't there a big famous choir festival where they have a competition?
Yeah, now this is the Eisteddfod. Yeah, Llangollen is the international Eisteddfod, and people come. It's all forms of art, let's say singing, dancing, composition, recitation. But that's the international one at Llangollen. But the national Eisteddfod, which is the best of Wales, it's a funny festival in that it's the largest outdoor music festival in Europe. And it travels north to South Wales in alternate years and to a different town every year.
So every year there's a national choir singing festival,
yep,
competition.
Yeah.
And the word is
Eisteddfod.
Eisteddfod. We will have specifics on this festival, which sounds wonderful, and something that I've thoroughly enjoyed with every one of my visits, how you visit the choir at the pub after the practice, loosening their ties and singing on. And it's like Monday it's here, Tuesday it's there, Wednesday it's there. Every night of the week, somewhere within striking distance in your Welsh travels, you've got a chance to have a beer and sit down with the choir and enjoy them singing. And tourists feel very welcome there. And we'll put that on our ricksteves.com website. So if you want to enjoy the choirs that Martin Delandowitz is talking about, you can actually go there on your next trip to Wales. Wales is really quite ideal from a travel point of view. It's so accessible from England, yet it's so different. It's got wonderful B&Bs, fine public transit. Do the people speak English?
Oh, they do. Everybody speaks English as well as those that speak Welsh. They speak Welsh as well, but everybody speaks English.
I would bet you'd endure yourself to the Welsh people if you could say a few words.
Oh, you would. You would.
But I can't.
Oh, but you should. You should.
What five words should I learn in Welsh?
Right. You should learn good day. Bore da.
Bore da.
Bore da. Afternoon.
Bore da. So you get up and you step out of your bed and breakfast in the morning, you see someone in the streets. Bore da.
Bore da.
Oh, that would blow them away.
It would.
Okay, what else?
In the afternoon, you'd say pnawn da. And then, of course, you'd need to say thank you.
Thank you.
Which is diolch.
And you have to put all this guttural stuff in there.
Yeah.
Do it again.
Back of the throat sound. Diolch.
Diolch.
Oh, well said.
Diolch.
Diolch.
So that's thank you.
That's thank you. And of course, then there's you're welcome, which is croeso.
Croeso. So this is not that tough. You would write that down on a little 3x5 card in your pocket. You'd memorize these five words. And you're in a pub, you're having a drink, and you look over the next guy, and you raise your mug, and you say?
You would say good health, which is yechid.
Yachi.
Yechid da. Yechid da.
Yechid da. Yachi da. Hey, tell me a tongue twister that children would we have our tongue twisters in English, a Welsh tongue twister. That would be like the ultimate tongue twister, I would imagine.
The lorry rolled down the hill. Rolio'r lorry lawr yr allt.
Say it again.
Rolio'r lorry I lawr yr allt.
I'll stick to yucky da. Yucky da. Oh, Martin Delandowitz, it's so great to talk to you. It makes me want to go back to Wales.
Hey, you'd be welcome, Rick. You'd be well welcome.
That's great. Thank you very much, Martin Delandowitz. This is Rick Steves, and it's Travel with Rick Steves. How do you say thank you again?
Diolch yn fawr. Diolch.
Diolch yn fawr. Martin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rick Steves teaches smart travel to Great Britain, Ireland, and beyond. On Rick's website, you'll find an archive of interviews from his radio show, free audio tours, a monthly travel newsletter, and a world of information to help you turn your travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. To prepare for your next adventure in Great Britain or Ireland, begin your trip at ricksteves.com.